Welcome to the MRI Cast. These podcasts focus on various current topics in MRI. We invite you to ask questions via the website and even suggest topics for future MRI Cast. The opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect standards in clinical practices, nor should they be considered as medical advice. This program is made possible by an unrestricted educational grant from Bracco Diagnostics. Well, hello everyone again, and welcome to the MRI Cast. These podcasts are sponsored by an unrestricted educational grant from Bracco Diagnostics, and we certainly want to thank them for their support. Now, with me today is my co-host, Dr. Howard Raleigh.
Hi, good morning, Bill Faulkner. Your voice is arrestingly beautiful, appropriate for today's topic.
Yeah, that's disconcerting. Because the topic of this episode is MR imaging of patients with implanted cardiac electronic devices, which you might see abbreviated as ICED. We're going to discuss the types of devices with MR conditional labeling, but more so, we're going to be addressing the use of MRI in patients with non-labeled devices. So these are devices that do not have conditional labeling. Now, with us today is our guest, Vera Kimbrell. Welcome, Vera.
Hi, Bill.
Don't forget Howard. He's there too.
Oh, hi, Howard.
Yeah, you don't want to.
I already forgot. Howard.
Don't want to be left out.
Yeah, you know, he's real sensitive.
I understand.
Well, I've known Vera actually for well over 20 years, and I got to say she hasn't aged a bit. But I'd like to get Vera to tell us, and those listening, just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm Vera Kimbrell, and I've known Bill for 20 years, so I must be a little bit older than 20. I'm an MRI technologist. I'm at an academic medical center in the Northeast. I am also chair of the SMRT Safety Committee currently, and I do a bit of work with the Joint Working Group, which does labeling and guidelines for implanted devices internationally.
As you can tell, we've got a lot of expertise here. I know Howard at his facility has got some experience with scanning patients with non-conditional pacemakers. And so that's, again, like I said, that's really what we want to kind of focus on. Now, one of the things that I'd like to start with and get some opinions from the folks here around the table, if you will, has to do with terminology regarding devices that are untested. One of the things that in one of the working groups that both Vera and I participate in dealing with labeling of this is one of the problems is when you have a device that's not been tested, this does not necessarily mean it is unsafe. It simply means it hasn't been tested and doesn't have labeling. I mean, what are your guys', you know, opinion on that?
Well, you know, it used to be what we thought was an absolute contraindication to scan some of these older pacing devices or implanted devices. Synonyms that I've heard used would be legacy or conventional or traditional devices. And there have been probably 15 or 20 fatalities reported in earlier years with folks who were scanned and then had an event. We don't know solidly whether they were responsible or not, but there was always a lot of caution till about 2014, 2015, when a series came out showing that with appropriate protocols and safeguards built in, working with the team of electrophysiologists and physicists, most of these devices seem to be safe to scan, provided protocols are adhered to.
So everything Howard said is correct, of course. When we get a device that's untested, we throw it into the unknown category, and we start to try to find out, you know, everything we can about it. But as Howard said, we've learned that many things that we thought were completely contraindicated could be scanned if we used appropriate safety guidelines, which means that we, you know, we scan it on usually a 1.5 scanner. We monitor the patient all throughout the exam. If the patient can be if their pacemaker can be turned off or put in some kind of mode, then of course we do that. We talk to the cardiologist to make sure that if we do something to the pacemaker, that the patient will be okay. So there's all kinds of like levels of pre-work or pre-scan conditions that we try to follow for these unknown devices.
Now, Vera, I heard you do a presentation last November at Rush University on the MRI Safety Day for imaging patients with these types of unlabeled devices. And Howard mentioned one of you mentioned a date. Maybe it was Howard mentioned a date. And I was trying to look through my notes here. Either of you guys' institutions, if you have a patient with a device that is later than or earlier than, however you want to phrase it, date, what would that date be? Because I think most of the documented deaths that may have been associated with MRI and the pacemaker were in devices that were older devices. Now, several years ago, when the last revision of the major ACR safety document, they had a statement where I believe their wording was the ACR eschews the terminology of modern pacemakers, because that's what a lot of people have been saying, that if you've got one of these modern or newer pacemakers, you don't have they don't have the magnetic reed switch. They've changed their design so that they're not as problematic in an MRI. So I guess that's a big way around it. What kind of year is that, or can we even know? Do we even know that?
You know, I don't think it's so much the year. For me, it's, is it MRI conditional? In other words, do we have specific published guidelines that we know have been tested and they're safe at the parameters listed, or is it everything else? And so identifying the device is key. Even today, if one was put in last month, some cardiologists still put in conventional pacemakers or devices for some reason. We're seeing fewer and fewer of those, but it's conditional. Great. We know what the conditions are, or it's everything else, which for us means enhanced precautions and more monitoring. I'll see if Vera agrees with that.
Well, I do agree with that, but the date that you spoke of, Bill, so there was an article that came out, and I'm looking here at the date of this article, and of course I've cropped that part of it out. 2004 it came out, that said that between 1982 and 1996 were the most concerning legacy pacemakers or unsafe pacemakers. They had the most ferromagnetic content. So since 1996, there have been less ferromagnetic components. Now that doesn't make it necessarily safe. You're right about the reed switches and some of the other things that the conditional pacemakers have. But when you start to think about these pacemakers, you do a risk benefit. And regardless of how old the pacemaker is or what type of pacemaker it happens to be, you try to decide if the risk that you're going to put the patient through is greater than the benefit from the exam. So I think that's probably the take-home message for these legacy or unknown pacemakers. As long as you are willing to monitor the patients and, you know, have the cardiologist buy in for what you're getting ready to do, then you can mitigate some of the risks that you're going to undertake.
Let's talk about that for just a second, because there's two things that brings to mind, two things here that I've heard people ask over time. So, and Vera, I know you covered this in your presentation, but what specifically are the risks? I mean, we use three different magnetic fields, and each one of those magnetic fields has its own particular risk. So with regard to these particular cardiac devices, how would you summarize those main category risks and issues related to that?
Well, there's always the risk of ferromagnetic components, but we haven't seen a lot of that I mean, even the really, really, really old ones with the more ferromagnetic content probably aren't enough to do a ton of damage. The risk of RF heating, you know, is always a problem for anything that's metal, but I think we probably haven't seen a ton of that. The thing that we worry the most about is changing the setting of the pacemaker, you know, speeding it up, slowing it down, turning it off, you know, changing it in some way so that if the patient needs their device, then we're, you know, they're not getting the pacing that they need. And the answer to that for us has been to have a nurse constantly monitor the patient during the MRI. And if anything untold is going on in their vitals, then we stop the procedure. And there's a cardiologist standing by to help us with any issue that we run into. So I'd never feel comfortable doing it without that, without monitoring and without a cardiologist to help us. And I'm lucky enough to be in a large hospital. So, you know, I could run the patient to someplace that they could get help pretty quickly. But those are the things that I worry about. Howard, how do you feel about that?
I completely agree. I think every site has that's decided to scan pacemakers has hopefully adopted protocols similar to those published by the larger MagnaSafe or other trials. You know, and even before we get to the pacemaker and how to monitor it, there has to be an intake point where we say, well, are there alternative imaging modalities that'll answer the question? That's fantastic. But there are still a lot of patients, especially brain tumors or oncologic applications or even heart studies, that really do require it. So it goes back to exactly what you said, Vera, the risk benefit. Now, we have sort of two pathways, one for the conditional and one for the everything else, the enhanced precautions with legacy devices or older pacemakers. And we have a slightly lower monitoring team for the MRI conditionals. And then for the more risky, potentially more risky unknown devices or legacy devices, that's where we bring in the EP, the electrophysiology, cardiology attending has to be present and available to respond within 2 minutes. In either case, we have ACLS trained nurses who are familiar with programming the devices with whatever tools they need to program standing by. And of course, these are all at 1.5T normal mode. And we confer with the physicist as well. To make sure we were set for low energy modes.
One of the things that I remember reading about relative to the risk associated with these types of devices is lead tip heating, which from a physics standpoint seems like it would more likely occur with or from the RF pulse based on lead tip. And one of the things, Vera talked about device changes. One of the things that, again, I remember reading about is that when you have lead tip heating, one of the indicators that this has occurred is that the capture threshold will change. For those of you listening, and you guys correct me if I'm wrong on this, but when they install a pacemaker, they screw the lead. It's kind of literally like a small corkscrew on the tip of the lead and screws down into the myocardium. And of course that kills tissue. And so when they then go to set the pacing capture threshold, which is the voltage required to capture and pace the heart, it depends on the amount of dead tissue at the tip of that lead, which can change over, you know, a period of days in and of itself. But once it kind of gets settled in, it's pretty much changed. And what has been noted in even in these MagSafe registries and things where they say there's no, you know, adverse events, they do in fact note, and again, I would love to know if I'm incorrect in this, they do in fact have documented that there have been some pacing capture threshold changes. Now, to the cardiologist, it's like, yeah, whatever, yeah, we'll change it. But that does indicate some lead tip heating. Am I correct in that? That can occur.
It certainly can occur, and it's measured in a couple of ways. There's the pacing capture threshold, which is the volts, the minimal electrical volts needed to consistently depolarize or capture the myocardium. There's lead impedance, which is a measure of the opposition of current flow through the device leads measured in ohms. And so that's the reason why it's always recommended to immediately after the procedure to check those sorts of thresholds and usually get a follow-up in 6 months or so. And they can change. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why there's a recommendation, although not hard and fast for us, to wait at least 6 weeks after implantation before doing an MRI, since that initial healing phase can change the settings, these thresholds on devices.
Vera, any comment or input on that?
So we do the same thing. We wait 6 weeks before we scan even the conditional pacemakers for exactly that.
We've actually recently loosened that up a little bit, and our most recent guidelines at the University of Wisconsin are that we're willing to scan within 2 weeks. And if there's a very good reason, we'll even scan before that, you know, something like cardiac pacemaker, and now they have suspected spinal cord compression from a tumor or something. Again, it comes back to common sense and risk-benefit analysis.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. We would do the same, you know, if there was a big benefit, you know, for the patient, but 6 weeks is on our guidelines.
You know, okay. Bill, I want to say one thing real quickly, and that is we're particularly anxious around abandoned leads or components because it turns out there's much greater sort of antenna effect for a lead that's not connected to a pacemaker device. And so we're extremely reluctant to scan those patients for fear we might either burn something or create a current through that abandoned wire, basically.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, let me mention to everybody listening that the real key here thing for an abandoned lead is that what you have is you have a wire that is insulated across its entire length, except for the points, which in reality is a worst case scenario. If you've got something that's not insulated, then typically the RF is dissipated over the whole length. And hopefully we can address stuff like this on a future podcast. We're talking about doing some safety stuff, and this would be a great topic for that. But yeah, that's why abandoned leads are really much more of a, I would think, higher likelihood, higher rent likelihood of having an issue, as opposed to based on experience that everybody has with the legacy devices.
And so here we're talking about endocardial leads, the temporary epicardial pacemaker leads, which are thinner and usually coiled up and sometimes cut off at the skin. We'll scan those, but we're very reluctant with retained components of endocardial leads, things that are put in with a pacemaker and then abandoned later.
Yeah, the epicardial leads are, you know, as a general rule, an abandoned one of those are fairly short,
yes,
right? I mean,
that's
typically.
Right.
Now, along this line before, as we get on into this, I'm looking through some of my notes here and I made a note of something. Talking about the risk, and we discussed some of those risks, and we talked about a risk versus benefit analysis. Who's actually responsible for determining, in you guys' opinion, who's responsible for determining if the benefit to the patient outweighs any risk from exposure to an MRI exam?
So that would be Howard.
Thank you, Vera. So kind of you.
That would be Howard. Yes, that's what I wanted to hear.
All right. I'll give you a would-be answer then. Well, in our site, like I think most, it starts with an order from a referring physician, which I don't view as an order, but a request or a consultation.
Yeah.
And I'll then call up the doc and have a back and forth about what they need to know. And is there another way to get that information without an MRI? And then having done that risk benefit assessment, it next passes off to the cardiologist who takes care of the patient. And the EP team will specify and go through a checklist on exactly what the device is. Actually, our safety nurses often determine that in advance. But then the cardiologist speaks with the patient in advance and actually consents them over the telephone, going through the cardiac perspective of, you know, what could or could not happen and whether we might damage their device, et cetera. And then they're scheduled with the appropriate personnel according to whether they're conditional or something else with lower or higher numbers of people available. And the day they come down for the procedure, the radiologist, again, consents them, make sure that we're all on the same page. So we do a dual consent after conferring and documenting the discussion with the referring physician that we all think this is the right thing to do.
So we have a similar process to that, but we go through cardiology first. Not necessarily for a consent, but more for a consult. So every pacemaker patient gets a cardiology consult. And then the cardiologist makes a decision about whether or not the patient is a candidate for MRI. And then the radiologist gets the risk benefit. And we actually have an actual form that goes to the radiologist. And then they decide whether or not they want to move ahead, and they will be the one that consents along with the EP person, which could be a nurse or could be a technician or could be a cardiologist that will be on site to monitor the patient before they go into the MRI and to stay while the MRI is happening. Our biggest problem with all of this is coordinating that, coordinating the cardiology time, and the nursing time and the MRI time, and it can be a little bit of a juggling act. And some of these patients can get scheduled far out for the non-urgent cases. But of course, the inpatient cases, you know, have to get done pretty quickly.
Well, it would seem to me like those would be the easier one to get everybody around on, you know, the inpatient
are.
Ones.
Yeah, they.
You know, and those would be the kind where, to Howard's point, you've got a neurosurgeon comes in or an oncologist or something, and they go, we need an exam on this patient. The patient's got a pacemaker. So then you've got to get cardiology involved and all of that to, you know, towards you guys, procedures, as we've been talking about here. And I think that's kind of an important point to mention. These patients need, and I see if you guys agree with me for the people that are listening, to do this, there's plenty of literature out there that tells you procedures. The, what is it, Heart Rhythm Society, they got like a 50-something page procedure or document that covers this stuff. There's plenty of stuff out there, but you've got to have a plan. You have to have a plan, and you have to, you can't just dump this on cardiology. And I think this is where I've heard a lot of people say, well, we'll do it as long as the cardiologist will consent to them.
Well, in a busy day, cardiology isn't at our beck and call, nor are we at theirs, but, it can be a little bit problematic for the schedule and for the patient, for everybody involved to try to do this, you know, at the spur of the moment. It works a lot better if you have a little bit of time to coordinate everybody and get them around the table before you get started.
And the workflow is really important. We've seen an explosion in the number of implanted devices we've been scanning. I got some numbers this morning. In 2017, we did 45 conditional and 43 legacy pacemakers or devices. And in 2019, we did 361 exams, so almost one a day. And so setting it up and having a very clear-cut protocol is important for us. We only do these Monday through Friday. At regular times, it would be truly exceptional to do it after hours or on the weekend. Usually, most emergent things can be handled with CT or other methods. And we only do them at our main large hospital, university hospital site at 1.5T with the same team of people in rotation, because this is something that has to be smooth and practiced and has to follow those guidelines.
One of the things that, you know, we've been talking about here, and I think it's important to make this clear and see if you guys, again, agree with me on this. The viewpoint we've always had is, in this type of scenario, the cardiologist, EP, the cardiology people, are responsible for the cardiac safety of the patient. The radiologist is responsible for the MRI safety of the patient, and radiologists must be involved with this. You cannot do this simply relying on cardiology. Just doesn't work.
I agree with that 100%. And we actually make it the attending radiologist's final say-so about whether they go in or not. So I don't care if a neurosurgeon or an oncologist comes stomping down and wants this.
They don't do that, do they?
Well, in other places they do. They're really nice here in Wisconsin. But we once in a while have to reluctantly, you know, and politely turn people away, especially on a weekend or something. And we just, you know, over time, we may get more resources from the hospital so we can have the right people 24/7. But at the moment, we like having the core team available. And that's why we've limited this to radiologist attending approved and only Monday through Friday, regular business hours, at least in our center.
You know, we do the same. We we have done, you know, an occasional Saturday just because we got backlogged, but you know, we bring everybody in and people work overtime. The other thing that we do is we have a radiologist that after they've approved the exam, they have to check the images so that, you know, they're kind of on standby. So as we get the images, they check them to make sure that, you know, we've done everything that we need to do before we turn the pacemaker back on or before we finish with the exam.
So these pacemakers are going to be, to a certain extent, either, well, there's various modes. Again, I've learned some of this is some of the work we've done with some of the cardiac device manufacturers, that there's various modes that they can set these devices in. And they use terms like DOO, ODO, OOD. I mean, they've got all these funky, the three little terms. And somebody taught me one time that those three terms, the mnemonic to remember for that is PSI, and I believe it's pace, sense, and inhibit. So one's like an on and an off. And so there's various settings that they can set these pacemakers in. And that's what the cardiologist is charged with knowing how to set it. Is that correct?
So usually it's an EP nurse or an EP tech that does the pacer settings, but you're absolutely right. So it depends on the patient and what kind of pacemaker they have and how dependent they are on it. And, you know, some of them can go into MR mode, which is, you know, basically it just kind of paces at a normal rate, or they can turn the device off, or they can set it to not sense, or you're right. There's all kinds of different settings that, you know, that Howard probably understands way more than I do.
That has to do with the underlying etiology.
Correct. That's correct. We had a patient, probably the scariest one that I did was a patient that they gave some kind of drug to so that they could turn the pacemaker off, but that his heart would continue to beat.
So that's a good thing.
Yeah. So, you know, it all depends on how much they need the test and, you know, what the pacemaker is supposed to do.
And, you know, it usually comes down to, and this is all run by the cardiologists and set up prospectively, but the non-pacemaker dependent ICD patients, they turn detection and therapy, in other words, pacing off, and set a pacing mode based on the individual case. Then you have the non-pacemaker dependent pacemaker patients where the pacing mode is, again, individualized. The most worrisome ones are pacemaker dependent. They need their pacemaker. They're going to go into asystole. Those are ones where they set what's called an asynchronous pacing mode. And that just means a mode where the device delivers stimuli at preset intervals, independent of what the heart's doing, so that you keep their heart beating. So those are the main considerations, as I understand it, what the cardiologists are doing. And then everybody gets reprogrammed right after the scan.
So are there any types of patients, because you mentioned pacer-dependent, non-pacer-dependent, and, you know, for example, for those who have scanned conditional pacers, they will put them into what's called an asynchronous mode, which, as Howard mentioned, and the first time I heard the word asynchronous in conjunction with a pacemaker, it didn't sound like a good idea. I mean, just the two terms, pacemaker and asynchronous, for whatever it means, doesn't sound good. But asynchronous really simply means that it's put into a pacing mode and it paces the patient at a predetermined or fixed rate. It just paces them. And one of the things people listening need to understand is if you have a patient, this is extra, you didn't pay for this. If you have a patient that is with a conditional pacemaker, who is not used to being paced. In other words, the pacemaker only kicks in when they need it. So this patient can feel it when they're being paced. They can tell when they're being paced and when they're not being paced. And since it only kicks in when they need it, this gives these patients a little bit of anxiety. And I've heard this explained to me that so when you put one of these patients into this mode, that they can get real anxious simply because they're being paced. So as the MRI technologist, I think it's important to understand that and reassure the patient that they'll get them back to their normal mode when we're done. But what I wanted to ask was, so are there, and I got off on that tangent, sorry, are there any types of patients and or devices that you really just don't want to do? I mean, it's kind of like these are the worst kind. I'm not saying you wouldn't do it, but I mean, these are the ones that, to your point, worry you the most or the most concerning.
Well, we will scan virtually anyone with enhanced precautions, the exception being those retained endocardial leads. We just won't go near those at the current time. You know, as long as cardiology is on board and feels they can set up an appropriate pacing mode, we'll scan any of the legacy devices.
So we will scan anything that the cardiologist feels like scanning. So, you know, if the cardiologist is the person that knows them best, they're, you know, they know what these people can do and what they can't do. So if they're comfortable, then we're comfortable. And if they're there to, you know, to help us in case something goes wrong, then, you know, then we're there to try to scan the patient. Our nurses, because we have radiology nurses, sometimes get really nervous with some of these more risky pacemakers. So it's not without angst that we go into this. And I, you know, honestly, our techs are a little bit concerned. You know, we grew up in MRI, you know, stopping everybody with a pacemaker at, you know, at zone one. We were a little nervous if they got to zone two. And, you know, we really started to like heart palpitations if they got to zone three. So it's, you know, it's a little scary for all of us, you know, when we start doing patients that are, you know, have these legacy or unknown or untested pacemakers. But, you know, honestly, of all the ones we've done, because our business has been kind of like Howard's, it's skyrocketed this year. We've only had a couple of minor issues.
And CMS has now issued a directive that they're willing to pay for these, which makes a practical difference for a lot of places. And maybe it shouldn't, but that's the truth. And so CMS won't reimburse, as I understand it, when they're abandoned leads, but they will reimburse for either conditional or legacy devices where a protocol is followed, that like we've seen with either standard or enhanced precautions.
And that's certainly different than the way it was because, you know, in years gone by, Medicare would not reimburse for anything that didn't have a label. And with all this information out there, it looks like this is going to get more and more common. But, you know, I think everybody needs to understand this is not something you do as easily as you do a conditional device. Conditional devices are, you know, follow the conditions of use and the risk are extremely low below, I mean, very, very, very low. The with the legacy devices, yes, there are papers out there that say that, you know, basically we've done these, you know, tens of thousands of patients and have had no injuries. Now that or no major issues or no deaths, certainly. And you know, that doesn't mean it's safe. It just means that to Howard's point, and I like the way you phrase it with enhanced monitoring and stuff. And I think this is kind of, nobody said this, but I'm just going to assume it would be a rare day that you would do one of these types of patients under anesthesia or heavy sedation where you couldn't communicate with the patient. Would that be correct?
Well, it's not, I wouldn't use the word rare. We don't do it as often. And if the patient is sedated, we monitor anymore. We monitor the same, you know, regardless of how we monitor. But it, okay. You know, it's something that we pay a lot more attention to. And we, you know, the risk benefit would get a little more, it would lean more to the risk than a normal, you know, what we call walkie-talkie, you know, somebody that can walk in and lay down. But we do a fair amount of patients that are on some kind of sedation.
And, you know, you're already using a precaution of 1.5 only, normal scan mode, 2 watts per kilo, et cetera. So you're doing the things you normally do for, say, an intubated patient who's sedated. So we're okay with doing patients who need that.
Okay.
So okay. I just want to say, I know we're running out of time, and I just want to talk about what we mean when we say monitoring.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
So I hear sites that make me cringe, that they use the cardiac pulse gating device that goes with the scanner that they use for, you know, cardiac gating. And that's not a monitoring device. You know, a monitoring device is something that you buy that says monitoring device, and it monitors the pulse ox and the blood pressure, and that you're, you know, actually have a nurse that's looking at this, or an anesthesiologist that's looking at this, or someone that's trained to monitor patients, and that somebody's worked the patient up before they go on. They know what their blood pressure and their pulse ox is before they go on the scanner, and so they know what to look for as we do the exam. So I think it's pretty important that this monitoring part of the test isn't taken lightly, and it isn't put on the techs to do without the proper equipment.
That's right. And we require at least one ACLS-trained staff member to be present for any of these devices. And for those with enhanced precautions, typically the legacy devices, we require that it's a cardiac device clinic nurse who's ACLS-trained, plus an EP, electrophysiology attending or fellow, has to be present for the entire time the patient's in the suite.
Yeah, I think those are excellent guidelines.
So scanning patients that have these legacy or cardiac devices that have not been tested is a issue that is really kind of a major issue, and that has to do with the number of devices that are out there. Vera, what can you tell us about that?
Well, I can tell you that as of, and this is an old slide, but as of 2000 or 2011, there were 235,000 cardiac pacemakers placed. So that was 10 years ago. So my guess is that at this point, that's more than doubled. As we live longer and these devices get more common, we're going to start to see more and more of them. So this is not a problem that's going to go away. This is a business that we're going to be in for quite some time, maybe the rest of our careers.
Well, I think that, you know, eventually people, you know, as newer models come out and they're going to be likely going to be MR conditional, it will diminish over time, but it's going to be a long, so these things have like quite a 10-year lifespan.
At least, yeah.
Right. So 10 plus years. And they're, you know, these people are going to get, they're getting older, they're getting sicker, and they're going to need care. And MRI is a very important part of that care. Would you agree with it, Howard?
Go ahead, Howard.
Totally agree, Bill. We're seeing an explosion in this business, and we're willing to do it. We have the protocols, and so we're getting outside referrals from sites that, you know, either don't have the capacity or willingness to do these scans.
All right. Well, I hate to pull the plug on this. Sorry, no pun intended again. but I want to thank Vera for joining Howard and myself today for this MRI cast. I think it's been extremely, extremely informational. I want to remind everyone listening that you can subscribe to these podcasts via the main website. You can also enter questions at the main website. We'll be glad to address them in future podcasts. And if you have any suggestions for topics, please put that in there as well. So we're going to say goodbye. Goodbye, Vera. Goodbye, Howard. Thank you again for joining us.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Bill. Vera. Thanks, Howard.
All right. You guys take care, and we'll see everyone next time on the very next MRI cast. Thank you very much. Be safe. You've been listening to MRI Cast. This program is made possible by an unrestricted educational grant from Bracco Diagnostics.